Welcome to How To Medieval, the how-to where two guys show you how to do it between the two of them. My name is Ari.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're going to talk to you about the different types of fighting styles and rule sets that are out there for people who want to take their medieval hobby and do something a little more sportive, martial, combative with their armor, with their gear, and how different groups have sort of started to, I mean, many of them have been around for a long time, but how you might encounter the ways in which people become martially inclined and semi-combative or competitive with their medieval kits. And I've sort of broken this down into four major styles. And so we're going to go ahead and give you an overview of how these work. Today isn't meant to be you learning specifically how to operate under any one of these rule systems. We'll talk to other people who are more specialized in each one of these categories in the future. But today we want you to make you aware so that if you're seeing some group or some people in a park, you can maybe get an eye of what organization may they be a part of, what kind of rule sets do they hold, and in a way, what does that mean about what they take as important when we're recreating medieval combat in modern settings? And the four major categories would be, of course, really one of the biggest organizations out there that has their own rule set is the SCA. And the SCA has some offshoots that use similar rule sets as they do. And then you have your Harness Fechten, which is your sort of HEMA almost type, though obviously when we think HEMA, we also think a lot of the black shirt modern fencing, and we're going to distinguish that's a completely different subset of conversation. And then you have your Bohurt, your Battle of the Nations style fighting, and then finally, especially when you're looking at organizations that do earlier period before plate is really an accessible or acceptable historical thing to wear, you have various forms of what I call rebated style combat. And so I think it'd be best if we start with the SCA, since it's probably one of the most well-known medieval fighting organizations out there. And most people, when they think of someone running around fighting in medieval harness, they're probably, especially your average, I don't know anything about medieval person, is likely to have seen SCA fighting.
Yeah, and the SCA does a really good job of sort of advertising their fighting. They use that as their biggest, I don't like to use the term recruitment, but a lot of people do use that term. It's sort of, they use it as their largest recruitment tool for new members. So,
well, it is a great selling point to some kid who's just seen Kingdom of Heaven for the first time, and they want to go and they want to swing a sword, and that's a great selling point.
Recruitment for me is that's just sort of quibbling with semantics for me. I just don't like the term because I think it makes it sound a little cultish.
Oh, that's a whole different conversation that about is whether or not any of these groups are a cult.
The most
so we'll put a pin in that one.
The most, it's the most fun you can have in a cult where you can actually drink the Kool-Aid.
Right? You might spend about as much money.
Exactly. But so yeah, the SCA is probably one of the better well-known, and I'm going to be really, really forthright here, and I'm going to probably say something that might make a lot of our listeners mad at me, but there's not really much similar to medieval fighting and SCA fighting. They're really a lot different. The SCA is its own. It really is its own martial art. I mean, if you want to be a good SCA fighter and be one of the best and, you know, go for crown and win crown, you have to train, and you have to train SCA fighting styles. There are people who are in the SCA who you try to incorporate historical fighting techniques into their fighting, and some of them do fairly well. But there are things that you do in the SCA fighting that you never do in any other type of combat sport. One of those things is called the flat snap. And it's basically where you just take your sword and you snap it quick across the head of a person. So it's like,
there's a reason that it has received the derogative moniker of stick tag. And you're right. It's probably on the list here. One of the sportiest and least historically based ways of fighting in medieval armor on our list. And that's okay in a way, because obviously, if as long as you know what you're getting into, I think of it, it's very much a sport, and like you said, a martial art at the same time, in the way that there's a difference between judo that you'd see people doing for in the Olympics, and then there's the street jujitsu that you do if you are in a alley bar brawl, right? So there's clearly a martial aspect and an art to being able to play the sport of judo, in the same way that there is a martial art in the way that you play the sport of, especially SCA heavy. When we're talking about with fighting with rattan, we're talking about the heavy weapon style. And as you were saying before we started the show, there's actually three major components to SCA fighting, and they're not all created equal. So we can't really, the hard part about having an umbrella conversation about the SCA is that there isn't one umbrella conversation we can have about this.
That's true. So let me back up a little, you know, if you're getting it backwards here. So SCA fighting, there are basically three different, you could almost call them schools. And you'll probably hear me during this conversation when talking with them refer to heavy fighting. Heavy fighting is the rattan fighting. And that is, they use rattan sticks, basically clubs. And it can almost be likened to, if you really want to try to put it into a historical context, sort of the baton tournaments and baton fighting that happened in late medieval times, you know, where they would go out and they'd have basically clubs of wood and they would try to club each other. They weren't really using historical techniques, and they were just out there trying to club each other for fun and points. So the slang, the sort of colloquial term for it, is heavy, because you have to, you in that one, you actually have to wear armor of some form, protective gear that is a little more than the other schools. Well, sort of. It again, it's nuanced, complicated. Then there's what's called the SCA rapier. An SCA rapier has actually come a long way. It used to be sort of derogatorily called swishy poke, because of course in the early days the easiest thing to come by was foils and épées and sabers and things like that. But it has actually evolved, and it has become in the SCA, there's more historical technique used in the SCA rapier than there is in the SCA rattan combat.
But it is something to point out that rapier specifically in the SCA is aimed at a much later period, almost post-medieval, for those who are kind of hitting the pre-Renaissance impressions. And it is not, though you do have to wear protection, in the same way that there's kind of a distinction between harness fechten and longsword sport HEMA, it's not really an armored fighting part of the SCA.
That is correct. So in that one, basically, you want to wear some padding, but it's almost a bloth fechten for like the shirt fighting or cloth fighting. So if you want to put it in like a HEMA historical context term, and they're not the heavy fighting, the rattan fighting. You do want to wear things that are going to protect you, because these guys swing for the fences, and it's like getting, you know, smacked with a baseball bat. I've had bruises from wearing, you know, underneath a thick gambeson and rigid, you know, kidney protection. You know, so because you literally are, you're getting beat with a stick. So, and a lot of guys they're fast and they're good and they hit hard. I'm not saying that the rapier isn't fast and good, and they also hit hard for what they do, but it isn't that high a caliber of hits that they're looking for. And then you have another school of SCA fighting, which is called cut and thrust. And that's sort of a halfway point between the rapier and the rattan. They're actually fighting with steel swords. They're not swinging for the fences like the heavy guys, but they're going a little harder than the rapier guys. And a lot of them are using historical techniques as well. So it's sort of like I said, a bridging gap between the two. the SCA heavy is probably the least historical of all the three SCA schools, because really it's the hardest part to incorporate historical fighting styles into. And that's just I'm not trying to, sound down on it or mean, because, it's a hell of a lot of fun. I did it for 15 years. And it's just a lot of fun. And some specialty tournaments use different rule sets than the standard SCA. Standard SCA heavy fighting is basically you're trying to get through a mail shirt and a spangin' helmet. The head's a legal target, torso's a legal target, hips, upper legs from the knees down is not a legal target. Shoulders are legal. Face thrusts are legal. Face shots are legal. Hands are legal. Things like that. Elbows, well, not. You're not supposed to aim for the elbows so much, but they can get hit, of course. Anything from the knee down doesn't count. The crotch is a legal target. You might. Nobody might not want to play with you if you hit them. If you keep hitting people there, but it is legal. I've never heard anybody call light on a crotch shot.
Right.
But anyway, so
if you want to be a knight in armor and you want to have some simulacrum of fighting as a knight in armor in the SCA context, what you're really going to end up falling under most is the heavy style. And the other two styles are something that we'll be able to talk about more in depth if we talk about a little more of a less of the armored fighting styles. But today, when we're thinking about it, you made a couple comments about SCA fighting that I want to clarify, especially when we're talking about the heavy, is what is the purpose of SCA fighting? Because you said something about if you want to go win crown tournament, if you want to, what is the goal of the actual sport here? Is it it's not as much as you were saying necessarily to recreate historical combat, but it's more to win. Is that how you would, is that an accurate description?
That's an accurate description. I mean, that's one of those questions, Ari, where if you ask 10 different SCA heavy fighters that question, they're going to give you 10 different answers.
Sure.
Really, but yeah, it is a, if you're in the tournament, so heavy fighting is basically split up between two different realms. There's the tournament fighting, which is, one-on-one tournaments, things like that, and go to the last man standing's winner type thing. And one of the things that the heavy does best is actually the melee fighting, where you have large groups of people on either side actually engaging in one another in combat. So that, again, is depending. There can be certain victory conditions, but again, that's you want to win. You're trying to knock everybody else down, and your side's supposed to have the last people standing to win. But if you're doing tournament, it's really more of a self-directed victory. How far do I want to go? What goals do I have? SCA heavy fighting at its core, though, is how the SCA kingdoms choose their kings. So they have a tournament, and they fight, and whoever wins that tournament, last man standing, like I said, becomes the king of that, becomes the prince of the kingdom for 6 months, and then they have their coronation, and then they're crowned king. So that's really where SCA heavy fighting started, was that first big garden party in California 55 years ago now, that they were just whacking each other with sticks and having a grand old time. And it sort of grew from that, and melees were added and things like that. And as they've gone, they've added rules, subtracted rules. Different weapons forms have been born. Different styles of fighting with them have been born. So it really is its own thing that has its own culture and its own school of fighting. And there are SCA fighters who are successful SCA fighters who are like, we call them Super Dukes. A Super Duke is if you win crown once, you become a count. If you win crown twice, you become a duke. If you win crown more than two times, they tend to call you a Super Duke because you keep winning. And some of the best dukes in the SCA have won. Gosh, I think Brian here, who's in the East Kingdom now, has won 13 times throughout different kingdoms. So it's he's considered one of the best fighters there was. There is, I'm pretty sure he's still active. I just don't think he's fought in Crown in a while. But anyway, they actually have their own schools of training people how to fight SCA style. One of the most famous SCA style fighting schools is Duke Paul Bellatrix. Bellatrix's school of fighting is he's published a book on SCA fighting. So it really is its own thing and its own culture that tries to follow a sort of pseudo medieval romanticized ish Victorian ideal of honor, dignity, things like that. So I mean, when I if Ari and I were fighting in SCA heavy combat, if I hit him, it's actually up to Ari to decide whether or not it was a good enough hit.
Now, what makes it good enough? Because you mentioned something about a mail shirt and a spangin helm. So does the armor you're wearing have any influence on whether or not your hits count?
The armor has no bearing. Caveat, there are certain specialized events and tournaments that do change the rules slightly to do that. But in general, regular SCA fighting, no. You could come in wearing a mail shirt and a spangin. Of course, you need the proper other protection. You need at least some sort of bar grill to cover your face, because face thrusts are a legal target and face hits are a legal target. You need a gorget for neck protection. You need rigid elbows and knees, rigid kidney protection, rigid sternum protection, and a cup. And gauntlets, of course. Unless, there's a caveat to that as well, unless you're using those famously horrible basket hilts on swords or a shield. You don't need to wear a gauntlet for those. I call them horrible because there's no true. I mean, people like to say, they're basket hilted swords, but for the greatest span of medieval era, there's no basket hilted swords out there. So these are just a sport. They're a sports tool. They're a safety device. If they've become part of the culture of fighting, that's what they use. But anyway, so that's what you need. I mean, really, it's not much in the grand scheme of things, grand scheme of fighting, what you need to be legal to go onto the field. The helmet has to be of a certain gauge or a certain material, gauge meaning thickness, and it has to be padded a certain amount, of course, all for safety reasons. So that's called, we call those guys minimal armor or min armors guys. So min kit is a term that I heard before. But then you can also have a guy walk out there in full cap-a-pie 15th century plate, and it doesn't matter if he gets hit as what's considered a reasonable amount of force. It doesn't matter. He's out.
It's, what do you mean a reasonable amount of force? How does a blow count?
Well, that's the million-dollar question when it comes to SCA fighting. it's up to you and up to your honor to decide, what is a good hit. And it gets harder for guys, because I fought in cap-a-pie for years, and it's harder for us to do that because we're better protected. It's harder for us to gauge. I used to actually gauge hits by sound, if it sounded like a good hit. I probably took hits that were far too gentle, but they sounded good, so I took them. But really, it's up to, it's up to what's a good hit to you. They have that rule of sufficient force of getting through a spangin and mail, but that's a really nebulous, sort of a nebulous, and by design it's nebulous, because it's supposed to be put on your honor of you're not going to cheat and shrug off hits. So most fighters that I know will start off giving you not super light, but moderate blows. And if you, they'll keep hitting you harder and cranking up the dial on you until you say good, if they can keep hitting you. And most fighters will say, you can tell. It's just one of those things. It's an experience thing. After you do it for a while, you get to know what a good hit feels like. You get to know what a good hit sounds like, and you just learn to take them. And there's some guys who, of course, it doesn't matter how hard you hit them. You could hit them with a Mack truck and they'll never say good, because they're just never going to say good. And we call those guys rhinos, and they're sort of famously sort of, and I've never met one. They're sort of the big bads of the SCA fighting world of, you know, oh, that guy's a rhino, he wouldn't take my shots. But personally, I've never met one. 99% of all fighters I've ever gone up against, they know a good hit, and they'll be a good, you know, they'll be honorable, as we call it, and say when it's a good hit. So
now, technique wise, obviously most of this is percussive style blows. You did say that thrusts are allowed. What other types of medieval style combat techniques that you would expect to see on a medieval battlefield are or aren't allowed in your typical heavy weapons fighting arena?
Well, I mean, so you just not allowed is probably the easiest. You can't grapple. You can't try to trip somebody. You can't, let's see, you can push off of their shield and things like that with your weapon or your other shield. You can't punch them or kick them or anything like that. So it really is just the percussiveness and thrust. I mean, there are different styles of fighting. So there are basically sword and shield. If you're hanging around SCA people, you hear them say sword and board. Basically, it's their sword and shield fighting. There's pole arm, which that also falls in a couple of different categories, because there's the unpadded pole, which I don't really care for. That's literally just a, you know, 7 foot long stick of rattan that has a duct tape, you know, smashing zone taped onto it. And then they have padded pole arms, and padded doesn't mean they're soft or anything like that, but it means that they have something on it to give it sort of a shape or heft to make it perform a little bit more like an actual medieval pole arm. There's two sword, so they actually are Florentine, whatever you want to call it, but they fight with two swords with no shield. There's great sword, which that's sort of open-ended to what you want to call a great sword. Basically, it's two-handed swords, and they come in different lengths. Anything over a certain length, I think it's something like 32 or 34 inches, is considered a great sword, but it has to be under 6 feet or something like that. And there's like sort of pole hammers and things that they fall into pole arms, but they're generally shorter. So, and really, they're sort of using things that somewhat resemble any number of medieval weapons. There's even experimental weapons you can use. There's an experiment for a while for using a flail of some sort. I don't know whatever happened to that, if that ever gained ground, because, or if they decided it was just too dangerous because it was too hard to control. But that's,
I mean, it's a pretty wild thing. So you're swinging that all around,
and you can't bash.
You can't pull blows and things like that. So.
And the thing is, you can't bash people in the face with your shield or anything like that, or hit them with your shield. So that's sort of the difference between when we go into the bow hurt side of it. That's sort of the difference between SCA fighting and bow hurt.
Let's go ahead and talk about bow hurt next then. So bow hurt is what people are familiar with when they see things like Battle of the Nations or whatever is historical medieval combat league. And there's a couple different names for it. And generally, and obviously there will be differences between different organizations. And I will be honest, I will acknowledge my lack of expertise. I only know of Bow Hurt based on what I have read online. I've never participated in it myself. However, with doing a little bit of research for this episode, as well as being familiar with the sport, just interacting in the medieval sphere, so to speak, it is, I would say, next down on the list of the sporty scale. Whereas if you're talking about the most sport and least martial, though I know that chafes some people, because I do acknowledge that there's a martial art to the sport. But when we're talking about on the threshold between something that's clearly a sport and something that is clearly a combat form, Bohert's pretty high on the sporty scale, but it's very much underneath SCA in that it allows a lot more types of strikes while at the same time restricting a bunch of them. So Bohert comes with a larger amount of uniform requirements because Bohert doesn't have any care for what the strikes actually do. In Bohert, the only objective is to eliminate your opponent by making them put a third point of contact on the ground. That's it. It doesn't matter where you hit them or how you hit them, more or less. And it doesn't matter whether or not you hit them with good structure or light structure, proper blade alignment, none of those things, in the same way that SCA doesn't have blade alignment because it has a round stick and it doesn't really have, you know, good, you're talking about the flat snap and things that aren't necessarily good sword technique if you were using a live blade. And it's the same kind of thing with Bohert. Your goal is this artificially structured goal is to simply knock someone down, make them put an arm down, make them take a knee, make them fall on their back. And if you can do that, then you've eliminated that person either in tournament or in a melee.
And I got to say, you know, doing the research too for the show, I never knew that the Bohert is from the old French Bihord, which literally just means wallop.
Well, yeah. So it is just like you were talking about, you know, in there were times in historical record where people just went out and clubbed each other for fun and profit. That's Bohert definitely takes the spirit of that and puts it in a codified rule based form where you just go out and clobber each other. And Bohert is notorious.
You're nicer than me because I was going to say Bohert takes the spirit of that, amps it up on Monster energy drinks.
See, now that is assuming that we are playing harder than medieval folk who went out to wallop each other did. And I'm not positive we do because we've actually gone and said, here's some very strict safety requirements to allow you to go clobber each other with even the modicum of safety, which I'm fairly certain our medieval brethren did not bother to do.
So I know that I know a little bit about Bohert just from coming in from the SCA because I've never done it myself. Well, I did do one round of what you might be able to call Bohert fighting with a guy a few years ago during a school demo. He's actually a Bohert fighter, and I went in and did a round with him. But anyway, that's getting off the. In the U.S., especially in my neck of the woods, at least. A lot of ex or even current SCA fighters decided, you know, I want to do more. I want to hit harder. I want to punch, kick, grapple, hit people with my shield, do a roundhouse flying kick, you know, donkey kick a guy, stuff like that. It's like, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. So they're the ones who actually started Bohert in the U.S. To a point. It's like, so I know. Jay Brooks and Kat Brooks, who started the Knights Hall up in Nashua, New Hampshire, and they used to be aligned with Andre. Of course, they've now split and gone their own ways. And he's doing. There's two leagues now in the U.S. It's like ACL, ACS, which is America's Combat Sports, and ACL or ASL or American Sports, I don't even know, Armored Sports League, or so it's like they've split their ways. And then a good friend of mine is Evan Ringo, who was a two-time U.S. longsword champion. Maybe we'll get him on to talk. He's a fun talk. But they've branched out into women's leagues and all sorts of things, and they are, you're right, they're definitely more organized as a sports league than anything else I know of. They are really trying to make it a professional sport in the U.S.
True, and it is very much, it is almost completely competition based, whereas we talk about what's the purpose of SCA fighting, and it depends on whether or not you're trying to reenact a mass battle or you're trying to win a crown tournament. And again, I'm glad you point out how many different alphabet organizations that are Bohurt style. When we talk about SCA combat and we talk about these other types of combat, that there's different rules set slightly by different kingdoms. Well, Bohurt, there are different rule sets based on each one of these organizations. Each league might have their own minor differences. What we're talking about are general concepts. And as you said, they are notorious for being the fighting style where people are proud of their concussions. The hits are not meant to break any specific threshold. They're simply meant to knock you out or knock you down. And the only thing that they really prohibit is thrusting. And that's because, you know, of all of the ways to protect yourself, it is more difficult to protect yourself from thrusts than from really being bludgeoned. And so they do prohibit thrusting, but they do allow grappling, tripping, kicking, punching, shield bashing, and all sorts of things. However, again, as we talked about, when you're going in here, the closest thing to historical combat that they tend to represent, though Bohurt does have some fairly articulate historical authenticity standards for their equipment within the context of the protection required for going as hard as they do, is they don't really represent any particular martial art, any historical martial art, except for they do probably better than anyone else give you a sense of what the pitched fighting for your life medieval brawl might have been. And when you're talking about, you know, two groups of armed men at arms who are just going at it to win and to live and beating each other and knocking each other down, and maybe a bunch of them are conscripts that aren't trained knights who don't have, you know, are highly advanced and intricate martial arts behind it. They haven't trained with a sword, and they just go at it because they want to be the ones who go home alive. That is what you see, and it's probably the best representation of your, I don't know, peasant revolt and what you would see in the streets in a pitched medieval brawl. So it does have that going for it, especially since everyone is expected to wear a higher level of authentic or presumably authentic outfit than necessarily. So, you know,
I'm not wincing.
Oh, you aren't? No. Again, the authenticity in intent is higher than necessarily, like you were talking about in the SCA, we didn't touch on it too much, but there's the allowance for things like covered plastic or mixing things from a bunch of different time zones, you know, having a helmet from one region and arm protection from three centuries later is allowable. Whereas in most of these ACL Bohurt style leagues, at least in their rule books, they acknowledge that you want your overall outfit to be coherent within a 50 degree timeline. And they want your shield to conform to whatever armor you're wearing, and your weapons should be reasonably consistent with what you're wearing culturally and such. And while they make a lot of concessions, mostly for safety, since they do go at each other so hard, the fields do have a more medievally look sometimes.
I will give you that. They do have a much more tighter rule set for, like you said, you know, basically you can as long as you're armored, you can portray any of these things, but you know, it has to be whatever you have to do within a 50 year time period or whatever. My issue with a lot of the Bohurt armor is one, and this is, again, I say things that makes us lose listeners all the time, and I'm sorry, Ari. To figure out how to say it, I should just say it. A lot of the guys do a lot of reverse engineering. They find something they like, and then they try to backtrack to try to get it documented instead of one. The next thing we'll talk about is like the harness faction. Well, they'll do the documentation and move forward from there.
Well, we have that problem with people and their impressions as well. Trying to justify. We talked about that a lot in the previous episode.
And a lot of the problem that's happened with a lot of sort of Bohurt armors, and it's not even so much the fighter's fault, the armor's fault, is they found things that sell, so they've all started copying each other.
Well, you also see, I think this is also an artifact of the fact that it is so competitive, And at some point, if one particular type of armor or equipment works consistently better within the rule set to achieve the goal that this one sport has designed, then you're going to see people gravitate toward the mean because it is so competition-based. There's really the only reason you get into it is to win. There's not a lot of, like, I know that some Bohurt groups are trying to have like a living history arm and they're trying to do other things, but if you're talking about the core of what it was designed for and what people have gravitated towards it, you tend to see people who want to game the game. And so you do see what is probably, you know, things that are the most effective, the most comfortable, the most easily accessible financially tend to become the most popular in this context. So you do see that a lot. And some of it's copying, but I think a lot of it has to do with just, if you want to win the game, there are certain tools that are better at it than others.
I think the one thing that comes to copying in my mind is the infamous Griffin helmet.
Yeah.
Basically, it was a helmet. It sort of looks like this, I don't know, proto great helm. You sort of see him sometimes with a movable visor, sometimes with not. But the documentation of it is really shifty. They're saying it resembles this great helm, like a 1365, 67 to 1375, 80 great helm, and they're pulling them from these sort of lower resolution effigies and artwork. And they're coming up with something that, yeah, sort of looks like what they're trying to do, but it's just, it misses on some key points. But it became insanely popular because it's very protective, good visibility, good breathing. It ticked all the boxes that they needed for protection, visibility, breathing, things like that.
And so because they were able to play the game better with it. Exactly. And that sort of goes along with what I was.
And it sort of exploded. And then a couple of years ago, it might have been last year, might have been the year before, their rules committee actually outlawed them because they said, we don't, you know, the Bohurt actually has, well, depending on the organization, I think most of them have this, but they actually have
an authenticity officer, right?
Exactly.
That authenticity shows up to events. Yeah.
That comes up with the authenticity rules of what the stuff should look like. So they outlawed this Griffin helmet. And there was just an explosion. I mean, there was like a hashtag save the Griffin for a long time. And I don't know if they actually ended up reversing the rules or not, but it's just one of those, like I said, and there's certain things that some of the armors do with some of the coat of plates has become like the go-to because they're light, they're protective, you know, so why wouldn't you use them? And there's some things that some armors do that makes me kind of go, I don't really know about that, but.
Well, you know, the Brigandine style is easier to fit to multiple people. So exactly. If you want, it's as protective when you're getting thwacked by somebody with a rebated steel falchion. It's as protective as a cuirass, but it is infinitely cheaper to churn out Brigandines that have straps that can adjust to various users compared to getting a cuirass front and back that fits you. And I think that's where a lot of it comes in.
But I think these are the reasons why even you know, Ari himself and I, we put this more, maybe not this sole reason, but this is one of the reasons why we put this more on the sport end of things than the historical end of things. Because while they try harder and have somewhat stricter rules than, say, the SCA, they're still not as strict as the next one we're going to talk about.
True. And I do acknowledge, you know, like I said, that there's more of an emphasis on playing the game than like the kit first. And the next one we're going to talk about is the HEMA style armored fighting, which is frequently referred to as Harness Fechten. I know, Matt, you used the term Bloss Fechten earlier, which is effectively the medieval outfit equivalent of the black jacket fencing that you see for like long point tournaments or long sword tournaments and things along those lines. But it's the idea of, it's kind of the HEMA, and for those who don't know, the historical European martial arts community is generally like if you're going to throw one footnote on the whole idea, is the concept of recreating the martial arts of, pick your culture, European martial arts, be it English, French, German, Italian, and to start with the resources we have for what they wrote down as how they fought with these weapons from a sophisticated point of view and recreate them. So it's intended to be like if there was an unbroken line and you were to go learn, I don't know if kendo is a sport version of Japanese fighting or if it's the actual long swordy stuff, but the idea is like if you think about Asian martial arts, you think about karate, you think about kenpo, you think about people who have, these are lineages back to when the martial art was a way of actually fighting bad guys, I guess. You know, that's the idea. We want to recreate what is clearly a broken line and reaccess those abilities to fight. And so there's an armored version. And the reason the term harness vectin comes out is that the majority of the surviving manuals, especially the most early translated ones in the infancy of the HEMA community, were German sources. And there are German sources as well as Italian ones on specifically people who are wearing armor and fighting that way. Now, lots of decisions or discussions as to whether or not these manuals were designed specifically for people who are doing like judicial duels or fighting for sport at tournaments, or if this was applicable to combat in the field. But the point to be made for if you're looking at HEMA style armored fighting is that they're going from the history first, and then they're trying, they generally have worked to build a system of safe and reasonably equitable fighting rule sets from what we know about historical fighting and how the armor and how the weapons interacted with each other. And so in SCA, you have weapons that don't represent real weapons at all, they're sticks. And then in Bohurt, you have rebated weapons, but they tend to make certain concessions for the fact that they have weight requirements so that you don't get things that are too heavy and cause too much percussion, since people do hit each other as hard as they do. Whereas in the HEMA style, you have weapons that are designed to be resemble as closely the weight, shape, and balance of weapons that you would have used if they weren't safety. Now, these are generally rebated weapons as well. I don't know of anyone who fights, and no one sane, who fights with sharpened weapons. That's just like if you fight too deadly with your friends, you don't have any friends to fight with anymore. And so, however, one of the big differences and one of the markers of what you would say is kind of the bridge between the sport and the history side, whereas this would be a much more historically based style of, obviously historically based style of combat, is that the armor and the weapons you use are intended to affect you based on how the armor and the weapons interact with each other. In that, if you cut someone with plate armor on, it doesn't hurt them because that's the idea behind plate. But if you stab someone through a gambeson, then it counts because that's how pointy things work on fabric. And so you have the two most notable rule sets that I'm most familiar with are the De Koven Concord and the Palmer Accords, and they seek to do a armor as worn style of fighting that incorporates the weapons how they would be used. And one of the differences I also would like to point out is that in the SCA, it's about sort of elimination, whereas most HEMA tournaments especially are generally about points, and points are about delivering blows that would have injured or killed the opponent with good structure, technique, and format. So wild, reckless blows, even if they count, are usually looked down on in the HEMA community, whereas reckless wild blows within reason in say Bohurt just get you the point you need because they knocked somebody down. And one of the big things is that whereas in the SCA they do allow thrusting sometimes, in all HEMA style armored fighting that I know of, thrusts are not only allowed, but they're effectively the primary way of scoring points against another armored opponent, because that's what we see in the fighting manuals. Because one of the weakest, as we mentioned before, or I think I said in the Bohurt section, it's very difficult to protect yourself from being stabbed because thrusts are so very powerful tool. And so one thing that they don't do so much in the HEMA style is just swinging against each other and using the armor as a piece of protective equipment that is then ignored when it comes to how you score, which I think is where you see a lot of that difference between what feels and looks authentic compared to some of the other fighting styles, because blows are meant to really represent what that blow could do to you if the tip of your weapon wasn't covered with a safety tip and the edge wasn't rebated, if that makes sense.
And so, yeah, I think that covers everything. I actually don't know if I have anything to add to that about harness.
Well,
harness is one of those things I've always wanted to give a try, but there's nobody up in my neck of the woods that has the same level of gear as I do.
Gear is a big thing in HEMA style harness specting, because you are at a bigger disadvantage the less stuff you have, since armor as worn is an important aspect of the system, as it was in the battlefield. The more armor you have, the better protected you are. That's why rich folk wanted bigger and better armor every year, is because they were able to afford it. And, you know, the peasant levy was, you know, something that a knight could mow down like grass because they didn't have the same level of protection. So in some ways, if you're just talking about like general access to your miscellaneous user, it is a little less equitable, because those who are equipped the best, and we've seen this, and I'm going to pointedly not call anyone out because I don't resent them in any way, but we have seen people who have a far lower level of skill and expertise be able to come out much better in individual duels because they happen to have a harness that's maybe 100 years more advanced than their opponent. And that causes a lot of difficulty sometimes. And in that respect, there are actually a couple modified rule sets. You see them called squire lists a lot, wherein the minimum armor requirement is lowered. And so it kind of forces everybody to have more vulnerable spots, because everyone is expected to default to a lower threshold of entrance. So you say you only have half harness right now, like it's just what you have access to, and you don't necessarily want to fight someone who has full Maximilian plate on. In a squire's list, it is encouraged for those who have more armor to, in the spirit of chivalry, dress down so that they are on a more level playing field. But there is a lot of gear wins in some respects. Also, what we find there is that there is, when we talk about more of an incentive towards historical technique, the idea isn't always necessarily to win, it's to fight well. And a lot of times you'll see HEMA tournaments where they will provide accolades to those who didn't win the tournament because they either fought with the most grace and dignity, they showed the most technical expertise, they were the most gracious in the fight, because HEMA combat is less about winning than Bohurt or SCA. And it's more about exploring what we can access as close as possible with as much fidelity as we can manage for safety and just the knowledge we have available to us to explore the fighting itself. And that's why I have always gravitated towards Harness Fechten, because it's very much living history. It makes me think of doing an immersion event where we go do a medieval camp out just to sort of feel what it's like to be a soldier on campaign. You know, the rule sets in the Dukovan Concord and Palmer Accords and similar rule sets very much encapsulate the spirit of I want to experience what it's like to have been a knight in a tournament. And it's much less about how do I win a tournament, if that makes sense.
So the SCA had an experimental, I think it's still experimental. I'm not sure what's going on. This is back. Just had really started pre pandemic, the year, you know, 2019, but they were calling it SCA Live Steel. Don't even get me going on the name, but we'll keep going. A lot of us had really hoped they were going to adopt a harness fetching model for this, because it just seemed like the natural, you know, the natural progression, especially with what was going on with cut and thrust and things like that. You had people who were starting to play with these historical methods. So we really thought this was going to be like the next level. And what it actually turned out to be was sort of a Bowherd light. And a lot of people were really excited about it. And, you know, good for them. They were excited about it. And I hope that for them, it flourishes and that they have a lot of fun with it. But I do think that the SCA has this, you know, opening in it for a harness fetching model, because there are people who do HEMA and even HEMA harness fetching who jump between these two worlds. And it's like, you know, why not bring it in? We can, you know, just something else for more people to do at an event. But that's sort of all the armored leveled stuff. Then we get into more of the Lost Fetch and the HEMA stuff. And I wanted to add sort of, there's an interesting counterpart, and it's newer than HEMA itself, but it was started in the United States by Damond Stith from, he's from Texas, Houston, I believe. And it's HAMA, and that's historical African martial arts. And it's really interesting what he's done with that stuff as well. It's harder because, of course, there aren't fight manuals to find, but there is some information that he's been using. It would be great to get him on, see if he'd like to talk about it a little much, because it is that sort of, you know, like you said, living history or even experimental archaeology in a way, trying to rediscover these fighting arts of you know, the African continent and things like that. He also does it, you know, Arab. There's like what's the other school? It's a Persian. It's not Rastafari. And I'm so sorry, everybody.
Oh no, that's the other side of the planet. Uh oh. Oh boy.
I don't remember what it. Maybe it's Razmafar. I'm butchering the pronunciation. I'm very sorry, but that's like the Indo-Arab Persian HEMA school, basically. So I mean, there's all of these different fighting schools out there, and they do stuff. I'm pretty sure it's Razmafar. I'll have to look it up. We can put it in the show notes. But they do armored fighting as well. So, and they're using historical armored fighting techniques as well. Another friend of mine, Frank Perrin, out of Rhode Island, he travels around teaching that, you know, sort of Indo-Persian techniques of armored fighting, and he's really good at it too.
Yeah, these are things that I tangentially have seen floating around and I find interesting, but I have no expertise in. And I definitely do support, though, the development of all forms of historical martial arts. If you have a passion for a particular culture, then I want to make sure there's space for that exploration. And I think that's really cool. I just don't know a lot about it myself.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about it either. Frank was trying to give me some dagger fighting lessons one day, and I was just like, so where do I wear my armor? And he's like, you don't wear armor on this stuff. And I'm just like, no.
So another thing I don't know a lot about, but did some research for this episode, is what I'm going to classify as an umbrella term: rebated steel combat. And these are the types of things you see in organizations like Regia Anglorum and Historia Normannis. I think the Vikings or some Viking groups tend to run along these style rule sets. And on the sporty scale, I don't really call them very sporting, but they are much more performative than any of these others, where even HEMA, being largely experiential over competitive, it's still, although it's fun to watch, not performative in the way that a lot of these styles are. And we see these a lot in Iron Age impressions, early medieval impressions, things where plate armor isn't available or would not be appropriate to wear. and to try and supplement the outfits with steel or with plastic or with sporting equipment that's hidden is just doesn't reflect the way people had to engage each other in combat in that era. And so you see shields, you see, you know, skull caps, you see hauberjins and hauberks and such. And so they have designed a series of rule sets that very much reflect the fact that you can't expect the majority of the people who are in this combat to have facial protection. They don't have access to gauntlets. You won't expect them to be wearing solid anything over their elbows or their knees. And so they tend to have a rule set which resembles, without, not as a critique, it resembles what you'll find in a lot of LARP agencies, where you'll see scoring systems where, based on, you know, to reflect, okay, so you can't reflect whether or not armor is worn if most people don't have armor that can protect you from an actual blow. So blows are meant to be felt but not hurt. The idea is to let your opponent know that you clearly hit them without hurting them. And your armor gives you more hits that you can take before you're, quote, dead. They have more restrictive target zones, and they generally have more restrictions against punching and hitting and kicking and using your shield as a weapon and such. But what you see here is it's an attempt at kind of threading the needle between what the SCA does, where it expects you to wear more protection than you're calling blows for, but it's not quite harness fecton, wherein your blows technically are armor as worn and it's judged from the outside. It's very much, did I get this hit? Did I get hit this many times? It's my turn to go down. And it makes me think a lot of gunpowder, early Enlightenment age, early modern reenactment, where no one's shooting rubber balls at each other to make sure that their hits count from their, you know, modified paintball flintlock. People are taking blows as it is best for the demonstration that they're doing or for the combat that they are trying to represent. You know, a World War II tactical, with or without an audience, people will take blows and go down because it's part of the experience. And in these medieval contexts, you see people who will take blows and go down because it looks good for the mass combat in general, and you're out there to have fun. And it's far less combative. And there's almost no, I would say, again, not having experienced it myself, really only reading through some of their pamphlets and their PDF rule sets, it seems to be far less competitive and far more collaborative, almost like storytelling. And so I would see these rebated systems as being, you know, group sort of experience. Like, you know, you do get that whole I'm on the field experience, but without having like a bow herd experience where the only way I'm going down is if you make me, which is a specific type of medieval experience. And it seems to really be sort of a soft form of a lot of the way, it seems to be a soft version of the way all of these other categories we talked about tend to focus specifically on a very, to be very accurate or competitive on.
I think you put it right when you're talking about, it's like, it's the reenactment combat system, basically, from what I understand. Yeah. That's when you go to if you go to a medieval reenactment, that's sort of the system most people are going to be using, where you're not swinging for the fences, you're not actually trying to hurt anybody, but you know, you're still having these reenactment battles. And you did put it more, you did say earlier that sort of framed it in a LARP way. And there are some LARPs that are sort of that poke, poke, one hit. We got to separate out, moving to the different episode. You know, there's that sort of amp guard dagger here LARP style, which is much faster, heavy hitting type thing. So,
but it also uses foam.
It does.
This is a rebated steel form where you do not want to make those historical concessions. And in fact, I think really the one of the most underpinnings that I can get, not having talked to someone who's in, say, who developed the rule set of Historia Normannis or something like that. But I feel the underpinnings, at least that I get from reading all of these different rule sets, is that the rules are designed to concede to the historical record instead of trying to make concessions in the material culture to achieve a rule set. And that was kind of what we talked about with Beauhurt, where they started with the game and they kind of slapped medieval paint on it as much as they could. Whereas in rebated steel, they really will soften things down and pull things back and change the rules to be less competitive so that they can keep the historic look and they can keep the equipment as authentic to what they were portraying as possible, so that you can have mixed fields of gambeson wearing peasant levies and full hauberk wearing knights without one or the other of them having to do something that is clearly artificial to the environment they would have otherwise been operating in.
I agree 100%. So,
and that sort of concludes what I would say are the four primary categories. And again, this is meant to be a sky view. There's so many nuances. Each rule set has their own conversation we can have. And Matt and I have talked about bringing people who are more specialized in each one of these areas to come and sort of explore these rule sets more. But the biggest thing I'd like you to make sure you take away from this, and if we haven't done that, if it's a little too muddy, because I know we have our outline and then sometimes we laugh at it and do our own thing anyway. The idea is, if you were to go to an event, you could identify what theme of combat you're getting into. Or on the other hand, if you're seeking out a group, what form would you find most engaging so you can look to find that type of arena? That's what I've hoped to achieve in this episode. If we haven't, go ahead and send us a message. I'd like to hear it, because then we can always clarify in future episodes.
And if you'd like to smack Ari and I with a stick, go on, give us the 5 stars, whatever you listen to us on. Help us beat the algorithm.
I like it. We keep our dad cards this episode.
But definitely, so we'll get some other people on who can help us break these down even better. I know some great people. And I'm sure they'd love to come on for the SCA. We'd even break down the SCA episodes from the heavy, the rapier, and the cut and thrust. I know people from all three. So,
and if you have anything you'd like to say on this topic, but you don't have a full question, you can either leave it in a comment on Facebook, you can leave it as a part of your review on whatever podcast app you're using, or if you want, you can send us an email in at howtomedieval@gmail.com, the TWO. And we'll play it here on the air, and maybe we'll discuss and respond and use it as part of the show. We're happy to hear your voice as much as we also love to see your comments written down. And, we should really start coming and actually reading out some of these comments. These people have left some good things to say. We should do maybe a compilation sometime soon of great comments. So I also want to thank Paul Butler for allowing us to use his composition as part of our introduction. You can find more of his music in the description below. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Thanks, folks.
Bye.